I appreciate that we can be here at Messiah and talk about Christianity. It's a gift. I've titled this series, The Christian Responsibility to Muslims. And I title it that because of a growing sense on my part of the geopolitical issues, issues within religious communities, issues between religious communities and modern, secular, liberal democratic society, and my growing concern about these matters. Those concerns have been kicking around in my mind for quite a long time. But since I had the privilege of spending time in Syria and Turkey, they have deepened. And I want to do the little bit I can do to try and engender a conversation about perhaps some other ways of going about things. I think tonight of my friend and colleague, Ibrahim Abu-Rabi, now of blessed memory, who is the ECMC chair in Islamic studies at the university. I met him 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, when he was lecturing for that position at the university. And after his lecture, a lecture which roamed from Indonesia to Algiers, a lecture in which he certainly demonstrated his extraordinary range as a scholar concerned with modern Islamic movements. After that lecture, since nobody invited him for lunch, I had the privilege of doing that. I suspect they didn't invite him for lunch because they'd already recognized that not only was he a substantive scholar, that wouldn't have gotten in the way, probably that he'd published far more books than most of them in the department, that may have gotten in the way. But the fact that he actually cared about living religious communities did get in the way, that he thought religious tradition actually means something for scholars of religion did get in the way. We shared that kind of commitment, and we went together over to Earls, as you know, right across the street from the North Campus, and I talked a little bit about the Ronning Center and about my concern to do some work on the sources within Islam to address issues of democracy, issues of human rights, issues of pluralism, and issues of the secular. What is the capacity of Islam to address those matters, to engage those matters? We became fast friends and spent the last 3 years doing probably 100 things together. Here, many of you know him, and then in Syria and in Turkey. And on the 22nd of July, he left this world. The thing that is so outstanding about Ibrahim is his notion of hospitality. He certainly saw, as much as anybody I know, that when it comes to these knotty matters, the development of hospitality is a kind of ground upon which we can learn to engage each other and depart in peace with gratitude, treasuring our differences even more than before. So I want to remember him, and I talked with him about this series, and he had suggested that they needed to be done for Muslims as well. And I said it would be great to have a parallel series, The Muslim Responsibility to Christians. I hope that along the path some Muslims will join us, and we will have a chance to think along with them as well. So, I'm grateful for his memory. A word about the series. My study of Islam began really when I went to the museum in 1972 or something like that. And Then in the 90s, I gathered a variety of the Muslim communities together in Edmonton. It's the first time that this variety of people from a variety of Muslim communities gathered in one place on the second floor of the museum. And I talked to them about a large research and documentation project I was interested in. I wanted to spend some time in the variety of communities talking and thinking with them about their living tradition, about their cultural memory, about their sense of place, about their historical experience. And so that unfolded, and it was an extraordinary gift to me. But it was in those conversations, in homes, in mosques, in places of business, that I certainly glimpsed in as rich a way as I am able, the life of faithful people trying to make some sense out of where they live, trying to make some sense out of the geopolitical issues that face the community here, trying to deal with the blowback from so much of what has gone on in our world in countries which are largely Muslim. I also saw them struggling with the issues of their tradition and modern culture. In 1979, when the Iranian Revolution occurred, it seemed to me that there was a bit of an opening when we saw the Shah of Iran, Pahlavis from the Peacock Throne, fly out of Tehran, and then in that extraordinary moment when the Ayatollah Khomeini, coming from Paris, his plane circling down, 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 and landing in Tehran, and millions of people on the street. I thought there was a new opening, because I knew that he was not simply some kind of conservative, which most of us in this part of the world, not necessarily here in Camrose, of course, where real conservatives live, but thanks be to God. But all of these people that pretend to be conservative and aren't. I thought that there was a new opening. And for a couple years, it seemed to me there was. But then, it seemed to me, you may see it differently, Washington and Moscow decided that the worst thing in the world was to have someone, to have some people, some country, figure out how to live the modern world according to a different paradigm. So they ganged up on him, isolated Iran, and you know where we are today. I paid attention to the development of virulent secular despots in the Arab and the Muslim world, from Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Turkey. We see them in a number of places. Paid a little attention to the rise of militant religious Muslim movements in many places and the resulting struggle for how Islam is to be defined. A struggle centered, at least in part, on the question of tradition and modernity, on tradition and modern culture. A question, at least in part, on what it means to be Muslim and to have a nation state and not an empire. As no doubt some of you know, Islam is most comfortable with an empire. It is not comfortable with a nation state. The struggle of religion and the secular, the struggle of traditional society and the modern West, that part of the world which most of us treasure, which has shaped most of us. And our current situation, in our current situation, we see the presence of the past all over the place. The echo of colonialism, we see surrogate rulers. This last year, they've been dropping like flies. We see virulent secularism. We see Wahhabist Islam and other forms of militant Islam trying to find a way to deal with what we usually refer to as the Arab Spring. I often wonder what the people in the Arab Spring call what's happening in the United States. The American Fall, perhaps. I'm not sure. I've watched the changing shape of Muslim communities in Canada from the 1970s. When I was first in a mosque in the 1970s, virtually everybody there was Lebanese. They were virtually all from a small village the Shouf Mountains, and they had virtually all descended from a half a dozen families that had come in the 1970s. I guess they had come 70 years ago up to Lac La Biche as the second wave of the fur trade. Not to trap furs, as the Métis would have done, but rather to harvest them, to raise mink, and to use that great lake, Lac La Biche, as the food source for their mink. And then they came down to Edmonton and established businesses on Jasper Avenue next door to Jewish businesses. And if you were to look, as I have done, in the record books of Beth Israel Synagogue and the record books of El Rashid Mosque, you find that the donations to build those two wonderful religious buildings have Muslim and Jewish names on all of the records for both of the buildings. And in the 1970s and following, the whole House of Islam comes. Turks, Iranians, Saudis, although most of them don't stay, they go back, they just make use of the University of Alberta. From Iraq, from Algeria, from Indonesia, the whole House of Islam comes. And then we come, of course, to September 11th and the terror of history and the intense way in which a kind of culture of fear has given an opportunity for the public imagination, I think, to be captured by virulent secularists and by virulent religious fundamentalists with damn little in between. So I've been thinking about the capacity of Christians out of the depth of faith and understanding and out of our particular historical experience to respond to this situation that we all face and that Muslims face in a particular kind of way. It has seemed to me that the only serious parallel that I see with what is going on in the Muslim world is at the time of the 30 Years' War, after the Reformation. It is a deep and serious struggle for how the faith will be defined and for how society will be shaped. I see the challenge of the gifts of secular society and of modern democracy. Extraordinary gifts that have come largely out of Christian culture and that our Muslim brothers and sisters need to hear about and reflect on. And I see that we are faced with the temptation for a whole new set of idolatries. So these four lectures and conversations are really born out of those sorts of concerns. And next week, the second one will explore what I call the landscape of Christian-Muslim conversation, in which I want to talk with you a little bit about the pathways that we might walk in order to resist the colonization of faith by those who would use it to deal death. And there are all sorts of people, as much on the virulent secular side as on the religious side, who wish to do that. The pathways for spiritual friendship, we have given an opportunity to cultivate in the midst of this struggle. And our stance as Christians, I will make an argument about this, in the face of a culture of fear and a culture of violence. In January, or February, I guess it is, there will be a third and a fourth talk. And in the third one, I want to invite you to think along with me and see what we might learn from both ancient and modern conversations between Christians and Muslims. Conversations that actually began in the days of Muhammad, began really before Mecca became the place over which he governed, as he had conversations with Jewish and Christian tribes and visits from delegations as far away as Yemen. And those conversations continued in the Christian East as the Christian East lost its empire to the new emerging empire, which is often considered Islamic. Down to the fall of Constantinople in 1453, one of the saddest days in Christian history, and several modern conversations as well. I want to walk into them because so much of our thinking about Islam and the way in which we, in the public discourse, the way in which it is portrayed and framed, doesn't come from the East. It comes from the great fears in Western Europe, which gave birth to that pushback, which we usually call the Crusades. I often say you can't blame people for fighting back. So there's a one-dimensional treatment of that as well. But because of what happens with the struggles in Western Europe, there's a very particular way in which that discourse gets shaped, which is quite different than the Christian East. Besides which, I just want to know and understand it better, and I think you might find it interesting to hear, because not many know about it. Paul Harlan is here. He knows everything about it, as well as about the 16th century. Right? 16th, you're teaching the 16th century. But tonight, in this first of the series, I want to begin by reflecting on how it has come about that so much of what is said publicly about Muslims and Islam has come to deepen our common wounds, feed on the festering of those wounds, how so much that is said pushes even good and well-intended women and men into silos built and maintained by fear. And I invite you to think with me about the enormous tragedy and the public danger of turning people into symbols. That's what happened on 9/11. That's what happens every time we have enemies. It occurs in the modern West, and it certainly occurs in Muslim contexts, and it occurs in Christian contexts. Part of the Christian responsibility, it seems to me, is to limit its reach, to recover the faces of those seen as symbols, and to do this in all quarters. In part, I'm doing this because of Pastor Ken Ward, who a couple years ago said to me, "David, I keep getting these damn emails." That's the second time I said damn like that. Well, we're in a Lutheran church, so that's legitimate then. Is that right? Where's my father when I need him? He had been dealing with some of what has gone on within church circles, and I've been getting some of those emails as well, and I appreciate deeply the concerns that they reflect. But God help us if that's the only way we have of thinking about these matters. So I begin here because this condition has colored so much public discourse, and because it is so contrary to the liberty Christians are offered by the best of teachers, our model, our teacher, and the Prince of Peace. So, to the task for tonight, turning persons into symbols. Someone who has actually tasted truth is not contentious for truth. Someone who is considered by people to be zealous for truth has not yet learned what truth is really like. Once he has truly learnt it, he will cease from zealousness on its behalf. Those are the words of Ephrem Isaac the Syrian. The words of a man who lived at the time of the Prophet Muhammad in Syria. The age of relativism is also the age of zealousness. They go hand in hand. Two codependent twins in service to the same human passion, symptoms of a shared disease. Both are responses to the longing of the human heart. Relativism and zealousness are distinct ways, it seems to me, of misunderstanding our deep desire for a firm truth. Both are misunderstandings in the strict sense, for they fail to discern aright what stands under the desire we have for that which is true. In both, we see this human desire turned into an appetite. Whenever we come to look at and care about is then forced into conformity with the idea, the image, or ritual that we have erected as absolute. We begin to hang all our hopes and dreams on the truth of our chosen framework, our precious absolutes, including the relativists' precious absolute that there is nothing of ultimate value. And our longing is captured by an absolute of our own making. It follows almost without saying that once we hang all of our hopes and dreams on something that we claim as absolute, it is a very, very short step to hanging all our fears on it as well. In this moment, the holy longing of the human heart and mind that lies behind the search for absolutes becomes polluted. Zealousness for the truth frames how we see and understand and reshape our responses to the fragility of the life of the world. And it is this passion, this disease, that St. Isaac says we are freed from when we learn what truth is really like. But we only open to learn what truth is like when our understanding of truth itself is transformed. So for the relativist, this transformation requires the letting go of the deep disappointment in the discovery that no abstract value, no matter how ultimate it may appear, holds in all times and places. The spiritual source of relativism, it seems to me, is often, if not always, a result of the loss of faith in the God of the philosophers. And it leads often and quickly to cynicism. If my absolute is not claimed by all, including God, then the search for absolutes is itself nothing but human foolishness. The zealous, often religious men and women, have yet to walk through the valley of shattered absolutes. They erect elaborate temples of truth, statement by statement, fact by fact, temples that have turrets strategically located on them, well-armed ones, poised to fire at a certain moment. Both the relativist and the zealous are, I sometimes think, spiritual adolescents at best. And in our fragile world, where the news media often shapes the public discourse, they have bonded with each other to divert attention away from serious encounters with what truth is really like. So this appetite for enemies that we so often see. I have been listening for a few years now to various people speak about Islam. Some are scholars of significance with a considerable reputation. Others are journalists, and others simply thoughtful men and women in the grip of fear. I've come to know some of these people. These women and men identify themselves usually with vigor, with either the right or the left in both religious and political circles. They identify a discrete set of cultural diseases with which they see in our present age, and I share at least a portion of their concern. Where I part company with both the right and the left, both with conservatives and liberals, and with their growing fraternities, is when they prescribe antidotes to our cultural diseases based on their relativism or their zealousness for the truth. The antidotes they describe to the cultural and political diseases that they see are one form or another, almost always, of either law, surgery, or war. The three last resorts brought forward when all else fails in human culture and our absolutes are deemed threatened. It is tragic to my mind that the antidotes offered by both sets of true believers frighten so many otherwise sensible people into drawing back from even admitting that there are diseases within our society that need our healing touch. And it is this condition that has left us with the endless dialectical standoff between polarized perspectives, conservative, liberal, secular, religious, the list goes on. Rather than seeking to heal the ills of society and culture, the zealous and the relativists have, over the last 50 years, masterfully figured out how to use up the entire social, cultural, and political oxygen as they square off over and over again to wrongly divide the word of truth. Both contribute with equal passion to the emotional landscape that traps the human spirit somewhere between indignation, despair, and cynicism. This is not a conservative problem. It's not a liberal problem. It's a joint creation of these dialectical positions, relativists, absolutists, the spiritual codependent twins of our age. So let me illustrate with some examples from both private and public sources on the kind of commentary on Islam and the arguments about its current geopolitical situation. A number of pundits who are zealous for the truth have begun to revive a thesis that we may understand the difference between Islam and Christianity simply by comparing the founding figures of the two faiths, Jesus Christ and Muhammad. I couldn't believe it when I first heard this. It was in my beloved church, a lecture given on Islam by a man whose name most of you would know and most of you might have some edges about. A very competent journalist and a remarkable human being in many ways. But he gave this talk, which kept me up all night as I began to muse on these things. And this is how he began. He began by saying we can understand the difference between Christianity and Islam by looking at the founders. What do we see? Jesus had no army, but died on a cross. Muhammad established a new political order and did so with the sword. This friend of mine in my church had been given an opportunity to be zealous for the truth of Christianity and to paint a picture of Muhammad of Islam and Muslims that used all the tropes of medieval hate literature from Western Europe. Muhammad, Muslims, indeed Islam, was turned into a symbol. I don't know how much you know about the images of Muhammad in the propaganda of Western Europe when it was under siege, fearing the coming of this empire and the triumph of Muslim troops, so-called Muslim troops. Muslim troops to me are just like Christian troops. It's a misnomer. The fears were justified. The pushback was enormous. Islam continued to grow and grow and grow, and Christianity has continued to be less significant, certainly as a political and geopolitical force. But he used all of these tropes. Each time I hear this starting point suggested by a person who stands on religious grounds, I'm taken aback. It seems to me that neither a thoughtful Christian nor Muslim would stumble into this way of treating or defining Jesus Christ or Muhammad. Here we have history stripped of its complexity and purpose to frame a kind of conclusion. It is what we have come to expect from journalists seeking easy copy and snappy headlines. My friend is a bit like that. From those who have spent too much time with a kind of reductionist historical tools around the scripture. From the perspective of the Christian tradition, this is clearly a false start, for it begins neither at the heart of human nature or in the presence of God's love. And there is no revelation, no understanding of Jesus Christ beginning any other place. It is also, of course, an enormous sin against the commandment, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." The amount of false witness we hear borne against Muslims is unbelievable in our day and age. What the zealous commentators then proceed to do is paint a picture of the founding period of Islam through the military actions of the Prophet Muhammad based on a set of historical facts. Easy to do. The facts are there. What do they mean? The Quran is mined to prove the point. God help us if we mine the Bible that way. We would be on deep common ground. This reduction of Islam to a militant religion with an appetite for conversion by the sword runs like a set of threads through European literature of the last 700 years. Its thesis and argument and its marshaling of facts is claimed by a curious set of fellow travelers. Some of them are zealous Christians engaged in an apology for the faith, like my fellow congregant. Some are deeply committed relativists solely concerned with the secular. Try Christopher Hitchens if you want an example. Formally, they share nothing of ultimate value, these different people coming from these different sources. But enemies need common enemies and thrive on each other's presence once they have found the common enemy. They claim, of course, to stand on different grounds, but this claim is simply a way of hiding from each other their relationship as codependent spiritual twins. This picture of both the Prophet and Islam is painted in pretty much the same way as my fellow congregant did that night in the church by the acclaimed novelist Salman Rushdie in his novel The Satanic Verses, published in 1988. At the time, I pointed out in a forum how this remarkable writer and virulent secular thinker and refugee from Islam was drawing on the standard tropes of medieval hate literature, originating largely in the Western Church as a result of threats from both the outside and the inside. One side, the expansion of Islam, and on the other, the collapse of the old order of the Roman Catholic Church in the face of the Reformation. Rushdie's depiction of the Prophet in all its clever awfulness led the Ayatollah Khomeini on February 14th, note it was Valentine's Day, 1989, to issue a fatwa placing a death sentence on the author and publisher for blaspheme against Islam. This caught the attention of the West, and the International Writers Association, PEN, came to support Rushdie and argue that freedom of expression is a modern absolute, the denial of which, it would seem, is far more dangerous than the effects of at least certain kinds of hate literature. The sentence was never carried out and was revoked under the Khatami regime in Iran in the late 1990s. But Rushdie's not alone. So now we have my Christian apologist, and we have the great, wonderful writer. Over a number of years, I've had a research and documentation project in the Muslim communities in Canada. I became friends with many who are devout Muslims, with some who have moved away from the disciplines of the faith, and with others who are refugees from their faith, almost refugees from childhood. Among the latter, there are a few women with fine educations whom I've come to appreciate very much and work with. They've led the protests at the outrageous treatment of women within countries where one form or another of what is presumed to be Sharia law has been implemented. These women, seized by the horrors of brutality in the name of Islam, also speak of Islam and its origins using the same tropes we find in medieval European hate literature. In the lecture, in my church, and in Rushdie's novel. The irony is that my conservative Christian friend, who is zealous for what he sees as the truth of Islam, the dark truth, has little sympathy either with Rushdie's secularism and absolutely no sympathy with feminists. Common enemies make strange bedfellows. And when we realize that they are bedfellows, it may be useful to think again about how they frame their common ground. For many, medieval hate literature is remote and perhaps unknown. And its similarity to the way my Christian friend Rushdie and some of the women's movement understand Islam may have escaped. But all of us have heard this type of depiction of Islam and Muslims in contemporary commentators from the right and from the left. Ezra Levant, check out his new book. Christopher Hitchens, you can name dozens of them. But for anyone who has even in a limited way has been exposed to the international news over the last number of years, there is a voice and a perspective on Islam that we all recognize as a part of the tradition of the rhetoric of fear, of those who are contentious for truth. It is a religious voice, and it comes, by its own definition, from Islam. In virtually all the broadcast videos of Osama bin Laden, that militant extremist who has left this world, the apostle of a new doctrine of jihad, the major financier of international terrorism and head of the Al-Qaeda network, and in the writings of his teacher and mentor, Said Qutb, the Egyptian literary critic, novelist, and poet educated at the University of Colorado, in literature, there are things to answer for, Paul. A novelist and a poet, we hear and read a call to young Muslims cast in terms of military adventure and death dealing, They present the same argument about Islam that I hear from those who are contentious for the truth on both the religious and secular side of public discussion on our continent. It is the argument of my Christian friend, as it is the implicit argument of Rushdie. It is the argument of the most deeply hurt feminist Muslims. It is striking. It is chilling. Qutb and bin Laden reduce Islam to a militant religion that closes the circle of faithfulness, requiring the believers give their life in the process of destroying those identified as infidels. Medieval hate literature, my Christian friend, some Rushdie, some of my friends who stand with absolute legitimacy for concerns for women in parts of the Muslim world. The argument is the same. They all reduce Islam to this matter. So why is the description of Islam given by Qutb and bin Laden the same as that of scholars and journalists who I've recently heard? Well, Muslims in general never reduce their faith to militant terms. I'm not saying some won't. I'm not saying if you don't back them against the wall, you might not get a line from them. But this is not the way Muslims understand their faith. What leads them, as well as Rushdie and some of those who critique Sharia, to the same body of images and ideas on the origins of Islam? Why this common narrative? In bin Laden's case, we must take up arms to be faithful. It's as simple as that. In the narrative of those on the virulent right and left, including Christians, Islam is also reduced by arguing that its foundations, its essential nature, demand that the faithful engage in conquest and destruction. We may learn by reflecting on what our companions are for particular positions we come to hold dear. A curious tradition of rhetoric stretches from medieval hate literature down to our own day. Militant Islamist movements claim this tradition. They have taken the infection into their body and seek to turn it into a virtue. This rhetorical landscape was central to Rushdie's novel, to the fear that led the writers who were associated with Penn to respond in the way they did. It is central to the fine women I have known who have been shaken to their roots by the horrific treatment of women found in countries shaped by some form or another of presumed Sharia. Osama bin Laden comes a little closer to winning this war for how Islam is going to be defined. Each time others voice his position and give young Muslim men and increasingly women something to die for amidst the complexities of our fragile and struggling world. When the religious right and secular left, or secular right and religious left, engage in such reductionisms of the faith of Islam, they contribute to bin Laden's case. So I suggest to you that each of these perspectives is driven by a kind of zealousness for truth. In each of them, truth has become coterminous with a set of facts, real or imagined. The result is a profound disease that St. Isaac the Syrian seeks to help us see. For him, zeal for truth is actually a symptom of a spiritual disease. Or perhaps, here I'm a liberal, as you all know, it is a condition that tends to develop at a certain stage in the spiritual life, and is itself simply a marker of that stage. I think that zealousness is the spiritual equivalent of adolescence. Where the young try out all sorts of ideas and actions with the conviction that no one else has ever had these thoughts or feelings, and they are exploring them for the first time. How can it be that no one else has ever seen just how important and ultimate these thoughts and feelings are? How clearly they see the facts? How simple and uncomplicated life is? Now, adolescence is not a disease, although some parents may at times think so. But rather, it is a part of the process of maturation. Similarly, when a spiritual father or mother sees the zealousness for truth spoken of by Saint Isaac, they recognize a stage in the spiritual development of the person. But just as with adolescence, if the condition persists, the process of spiritual growth is arrested, and one is stuck in the adolescent stage of the spiritual life. I began by suggesting that our age is an age of relativism and absolutism. At least within some quarters of our public life, we have elevated relativism to a kind of public dogma. Osama bin Laden saw this, as clearly as do many on the religious right. They share a religious vision, a way of seeing. A danger among some religious people is that they fixate on the cultural problem of relativism. When this happens, their fear leads them to reduce complex issues and themes to what they have come to understand in their zeal. If this persists, they also become captives of that stage of the spiritual life that Saint Isaac identified with zealousness for the truth. But Saint Isaac, contemporary of Muhammad, points to another possibility. When one has come, he says, to taste the truth, contention fades away, he tells us. Why? He is pointing to one of the distinctive insights we find in the ancient Christian East, I think has understood this matter fairly well. A concern for truth and the question of truth are never anchored in philosophical or theological ideas, concepts, or principles, and certainly not in historical fact. Fact is not truth, nor is truth fact. Truth is far beyond the reach of fact. That neither philosophical ideas or historical facts are cast in the language of the Christian teaching does not make them, or are cast, if they are cast in the language of Christian teaching, does not make them any more a matter of truth. You can dress them up all you like, but they remain exposed for what they are, simulacriums, pretends to truth. They all indicate that one has not tasted of the truth. The Orthodox teaching shaped by Isaac the Syrian and many other church fathers and mothers is that we must taste of truth and be healed of our appetite for philosophical truth and historical fact as if those were the source of our salvation. Our predilection for getting our teeth into imagined truth and holding on, for competing in pitting presumed truth against presumed truth. We need to be healed also from the habit of elevating facts to truth. We want the comfort of our truth statements, of our elevated theological, elevated theology clothed and philosophical doctrines. And we want them because we are addicted to the kind of spiritual adrenaline we feel at the sudden rush of winning an argument, at the rush of being on the right side, We want to be defenders of the faith, the kind of person who knows he is right and takes pride in staking a claim to what is true, no matter what the cost. It's not surprising that this attitude is growing in our day. The age of relativism, it seems to me, deepens the inclination of many to be zealous for the truth. And tragically, it does this for some of the best and some of the brightest among us as well, and dangerously so. The tragedy of all this, and it is a tragedy more than anything else, is that it turns human beings who are in the grip of trying to make sense out of what they most deeply treasure, their faith and relationship, in the case of Muslims, to the Prophet Muhammad, turns them into symbols in the war on terror. Christians have an ability to respond. Christians have a response ability. Christians can be responsible in the face of this habit of mind. We are called to better. We are called to better because in Him who is the truth and the life, not a philosophical or theological or moral idea, but a person, we are freed, we are called to be free from the habit of taking refuge in abstract notions of truth. If Jesus Christ did anything, He never reduced anyone to a symbol. Not even those who thought He was their enemy. If we taste of truth, as some of us are graced to do at every Eucharist, we know better than to see in the face of others anything but the image of God. Anything but the image of God. If we taste of truth every time we, like the disciples, find ourselves in one or another of the Emmauses of our life, breaking bread with a stranger, with someone we didn't know we knew, we know better. We know better every time our hearts are moved with compassion. No wonder St. Isaac says that when we learn what truth is really like, we will cease being zealous on its behalf. Cease responding as if it were our place to defend and protect the truth. If the history of religions teaches us anything, and I think it teaches us much, it teaches us that one of the most serious religious diseases is zealousness. Why? Because it turns people into symbols. It robs them of their face. It was a deep concern to Jesus as He walked the Valley of Galilee and the streets of Jerusalem. And He finally healed us of its bondage when He spoke from the throne of the cross to those who were contentious for the truth. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. For a brief moment, they were not Roman soldiers. He saw their face. They were not executioners. He saw their face. We are called to do likewise. In doing so, we may be part of that grace which pulls life from death, liberates human beings from the grip of symbolic identification and restores them to our fragile and struggling world. So, enough from me.